Now, there are approximately 7,500 languages spoken on the planet today. Of those, it's estimated that about 70% are at risk of not surviving the end of the 21st century. Every time a language dies, it's severing a connection that has lasted for hundreds to thousands of years to culture, to history, and to traditions, and to knowledge. The linguist Kenneth Hale once said that every time a language dies, it's like dropping an atom bomb on the Louvre. So the question is, why do languages die? Well, perhaps a simple answer might be that one can imagine authoritarian governments preventing people from speaking their native language, children being punished for speaking their language at school, or the government shutting down radio stations in the minority language. And this definitely happens in the past, and it still, to some extent, happens today. But the honest answer is that for the vast majority of the cases of language extinction, it's a much simpler and much more easy to explain answer. The languages go extinct because they are not passed down from one generation to the next. Every single time a person who speaks a minority language has a child, they go through a calculus. They ask themselves, do I pass my language down to my child, or do I instead teach them only the majority language? Essentially, there's a scale that goes on that they access in their heads, in which on one side, every single time in their lives that they've had an opportunity to use their native language for communication, for access to traditional culture, a stone is placed on the left side. And every time that they find themselves unable to use their native language and instead have to rely on the majority language, a stone's placed on the right side. Now, due to the strength and the dignity of being able to speak one's mother tongue, the stones on the left tend to be a bit heavier, but with enough stones on the right side, then eventually the scale tips, and then when a person makes the decision to pass their language down, they see their own language as more of a burden than a blessing. So the question is, how do we reverse this? First, we need to think about the fact that for any given language, there are certain social spheres that they can be used in. So any language that's a mother tongue spoken today can be used with one's family. A smaller set of languages can be used within one's community, smaller set maybe within one's region. And for a small handful of languages, they can be used for international communication. And then even across these spheres, there's the question of, can someone use their language for the purpose of education, or business, or in technology? So to better explain what I'm talking about here, I'd like to use an anecdote. Let's say that you are about to go on your dream vacation to India, and you have an 8-hour layover in Istanbul. Now, you weren't necessarily planning on visiting Turkey, but with your layover and with a Turkish friend telling you about an amazing restaurant that's not too far from the airport, you say, hey, you know, maybe I'll stop by during my layover. So you exit the airport, you get to your restaurant, and they hand you a menu, and the menu is entirely in Turkish. Now, let's say for the point of this exercise that you don't speak Turkish. What do you do? Well, best case scenario, you find someone who perhaps you can speak your native language, German, English, etc. But let's say it's not your lucky day and nobody in the restaurant can speak any German or any English. So what do you do? Well, if you're like me, and I imagine most of you, you'd probably turn to a technological solution. Machine translation or a digital dictionary, look up each word individually, and eventually order yourself a delicious Turkish meal. Now, let's imagine this scenario instead in which you are the native speaker of a minority language. Let's say Lower Sorbian. Lower Sorbian is an endangered language spoken here in Germany, about 100 kilometers, 130 kilometers to the southeast from here, that's spoken only by a few thousand people, mostly elderly. Now, let's say your mother tongue is Lower Sorbian. You end up in the restaurant. Now, of course, the odds of finding someone who speaks your native language in the restaurant is extraordinarily low. But, you know, again, you can just go to a technological solution. However, for your native language, these technological solutions don't exist. You would have to rely on German or English as your pivot language into Turkish. Now, of course, you still end up getting your delicious Turkish meal, but you begin to think about how difficult this would have been if you were your grandfather who spoke no German at all. Now, this is just a small incident, but it's going to place a stone on that left side of that scale, on the right side of that scale, rather, and make you think, perhaps, maybe when I have children, or maybe when I have another child, the burden that you went through with this may not be worth it to keep your language. And imagine if this was a scenario that was significantly more of significantly more importance, such as, for example, being at a hospital. Now, this is the point in which we can help. By we, I mean me and you in this room can help. We have the tools to be able to help this. If technological tools are available for people who speak minority and underserved languages, it puts a little finger on the scale, on the left side of the scale. Someone doesn't necessarily have to think that they have to rely on a minority language in order to interact with the outside world. Because it opens the social spheres a little bit more. So, of course, the ideal solution is that we have machine translation in every language in the world, but unfortunately, that's just not feasible. Machine translation requires large corpuses of text, and for many of these languages that are endangered or underserved, such data is simply not available. It's some of them aren't even commonly written. And thus, getting enough data to make a machine translation engine is unlikely. But what is available is lexical data. Through the work of many linguists over the past a few hundred years, dictionaries and grammars have been produced for most of the world's languages. But unfortunately, most of these works are not accessible or available to the world, let alone to speakers of these minority languages. Oftentimes, it's not an intentional process. A lot of times it's simply because the initial print run of these dictionaries was small, and the only copies are moldering away in a university library somewhere. But we have the ability to take that data and make it accessible to the world. The Wikimedia Foundation is one of the best organizations, I would say the best organization in the world for getting data available to the vast majority of the population of this planet. So let's work on that. So to explain a little bit about what we've been doing in this regard, I'd like to introduce my organization, PanLex, which is an organization that is attempting to collect lexical data for this purpose. We got started about 12 years ago at the University of Washington as a research project. The idea behind it was to show that inferred translations could create an effective translation device, essentially, a lexical translation device. This is an example from PanLex data itself. This is showing how to translate the word ev in Turkish, which means house, to Lower Sorbian, the language I was referring to earlier. So it's unlikely to find Turkish to Lower Sorbian dictionaries, but by passing it through many, many different intermediate languages, you can create effective translations. So once this was shown in the research project, the founder of PanLex, Dr. Jonathan Poole, decided, well, you know, why not actually just do this? So he started a nonprofit to collect as much lexical data as possible and make it accessible. That's what we've been doing for the past 12 years. In that time, we've collected thousands and thousands of dictionaries and extracted lexical data out of them and compiled a database that allows inferred lexical translation across any of Our current count is around 5,500 of the 7,500 languages in the world. And of course, we're constantly trying to expand that and expand the data on each individual language. So the next question is, what can we do to work together on this? We at PanLex have been extremely excited to watch the development on lexical data that Wikidata has been working on lately. It's very fascinating to see organizations that are working in a very similar sphere but in different aspects. And we are extremely excited to see the results of this from Wikidata. And also, we are looking forward to collaborating with Wikidata. I think that the special skills that we've developed over the past 12 years with not just collecting lexical data, but also in database design could be extremely useful for Wikidata. And on the other side, I think that I especially am excited about Wikidata's ability to do crowdsourcing of data. PanLex, currently, our sources are entirely printed lexical sources or other types of lexical sources, but we don't do any crowdsourcing. We simply don't have the infrastructure for it available, and of course, the Wikimedia Foundation is the world experts in crowdsourcing, so I'm really looking forward to seeing exactly how we can apply these skills together. But overall, I think the main thing to think about with this is that when we're working on these things, it's minute detail. We're sitting around looking at grammatical forms or paging our way through dictionaries, ancient dictionaries, or sometimes recently published dictionaries, and getting into written forms of words, and it feels very, very close up. But occasionally we need to remember to take a step back, and that even though what we're doing can feel even mundane at times, the work we're doing is extremely important. This is, in my opinion, the absolute best way that we can support endangered languages and make sure that the linguistic diversity of the planet is preserved up until the end of this century or longer. It's entirely possible that the work that we're doing today may result in languages being preserved and passed down and not going extinct. So, just remember that even if you're sitting around on your computer editing an individual entry and adding the dative form of a small minority language for every single noun, the little thing that you're doing right now might actually be partially responsible for making sure that language survives until the end of the century or longer. Thank you very much, and I'd like to open the floor to questions.
Thank you for your talk.
Thank you.
I just have a question about dictionaries. You said that you work with printed dictionaries.
Yes.
So my question is, what do you take from those dictionaries, and if there's any copyright thing you have to deal with?
I anticipated this to be the first question that I would get. So first off, for PanLex, we have, according to our legal resources that we have consulted, whereas the arrangement and organization of a dictionary is copyrightable, the translation itself is not considered copyrightable. A good example is, like, for example, a phone book is considered, at least according to US law, copyrightable, but saying that person X's phone number is digits D is not copyrightable. So, according to our legal scholars, this is how we can deal with this. But even if that's not a solid enough legal argument, one important thing to remember is that the vast majority of bits of lexical data is actually out of copyright. For a significant number of these are out of copyright, and thus can be used without. And the other thing is that oftentimes, for example, if we're working with a recently made print dictionary, rather than trying to scan it and OCR it, we just email the person who made it. And it turns out that most linguists are, like, really excited that their data can be made accessible. And so they're like, sure, please, just put it all in there and make it accessible. It's extraordinarily rare that we, so like I said, we have the, for at least according to our legal opinions, we have the ability, but even if you don't want to go with that, it's very easy to get the data publicly accessible.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi.
Can you say a little more about how the person who speaks Lower Serbian is accessing the data, like specifically how that information is getting to them and how that might help to convince them to teach their child that language?
Great, great question. And this is actually one that I think about a lot as well, because I think that when we talk about data access, there's actually like a multiple step of this, multiple steps. One is, of course, data preservation, make sure the data doesn't go away. Secondly is make sure it's interoperable and can be used. And thirdly is make sure that it's available. So for in Panlex's case, we have an API that can be used, but obviously that can't be used necessarily by an end user. But we've also developed interfaces and so, like for example, if you go to translate.panlex.org, you can do translations on our database. If you want to mess around with the API, just go to dev.panlex.org, and you can find a bunch of stuff on the API, or just api.panlex.org. And but there's another step too, which is that even if you make all of your data completely accessible with like tools that are super useful to be able to access it, if you don't actually promote the tools, then people won't actually be able to use it. And this is honestly kind of the thing that that isn't talked about enough, and I don't have a good answer for it. How do we make sure that, like, for example, I only was fairly recently, only a few years ago, got acquainted with Wikidata, and it's exactly the kind of thing that I'm interested in. So, like, how do we promote ourselves to others? I mean, I'm leaving that as an open question. Like I said, I don't have a good answer for this. But, of course, in order to do that, we still need to accomplish the first few steps.
If we want to have machine translation, don't we need a translation memory? I'm not sure that sort of the individual words that we put into Wikidata, or these short phrases that we put into Wikidata, either as ordinary Wikidata items or as Wikidata lexemes, are sufficient to do a proper translation. We need full sentences, for example, for...
Yeah, absolutely.
Where do we get this data structure? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that currently Wikidata is able to very well handle the issue of a translation memory. How translate wiki.net mm-hmm. for sort of getting into that gap mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Should we do anything in that respect, or should we?
Yeah, and I really appreciate your question. I touched on this a little bit earlier, but I'd love to reiterate it. This is precisely the reason why that Panlex works in lexical data, and why I'm excited about lexical data as opposed to, in addition to machine translation engines and machine translation in general. As you said, machine translation requires a specific kind of data. And that data is not available for most of the world's languages. For the vast majority of the world's languages, that simply is not available. But that doesn't mean we should just give up. Like, why? I mean, like, if I needed to translate my Turkish restaurant menu, then lexical translation will likely be an exceptionally good tool for that. Now, I'm not saying that you can use lexical translation to do perfect paragraph-to-paragraph translation. When I say lexical translation, I mean word-to-word. And word-to-word translation can be extremely useful. I mean, like, it's funny to think about it, but, you know, we didn't really have access to really good machine translation. Like, everyone didn't have access to that until fairly recently. And we still got by with dictionaries, and that's a great... they're an incredibly good resource. And the data is available, so why not make it available to the world at large and to the speakers of these languages?
Hi. What mechanisms do you have in place when the community itself... I'm over here.
Wait, where are you? Oh, there you are. Thank you.
Yeah, sorry. when the community itself doesn't want part of their data in Panlex. Yeah.
Great question. So the way that we work with that is that if a dictionary is published and made publicly available, That's a good indication. Like, and you know, you could buy it in a store, or you know, is at a university library where anyone can, or a public library anyone can access. That's a good indication that that decision has been made.
Please, Kimberly, could you speak in the microphone?
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah. Can you say it again just to make sure that everyone can hear?
Linguists don't always have the permission of the community in order to publish things. They oftentimes publish things without the consent of the community.
Yes, and that's absolutely true. And it's I would say that that is a that does happen. It's a, and it's I would say it's generally a small minority of cases, mostly confined to generally North America, although sometimes South American languages as well too. And it's something that we have to take into account. If we were to receive word, for example, that the data that is in Panlex is not should not be accessed by the greater world, then of course we'd remove it.
Good.
That doesn't mean, of course, that we'll listen to copyright trolls necessarily, but we will listen to traditional communities, and that's a big that's a major difference.
That's what I'm referring to. So
it brings up a really interesting point, which is that sometimes it's a really big question of who speaks for a language. I had some experience actually visiting the American Southwest and working with some groups who work on indigenous Puebloan languages out there. And some of the languages, so there's approximately six Puebloan languages, depending on how you slice it, spoken in that area. But they're divided amongst 18 different pueblos, and each one has their own tribal government. And each government may have a different opinion on whether the language should be accessible to outsiders or not. Now, of course, if it's, like, for example, Zuni Pueblo, it's a single pueblo that speaks Zuni language, so you just ask them, and they're really big on their language going everywhere. They put it on the street signs and everything. It's great. But for some of the other languages, you might have one group that says, "Yeah, we don't want our language being accessed by outsiders." But then you have the neighboring Pueblo who speaks the same language say, "We really want our language accessible to outsiders and in these using these technological tools because we want, you know, like our language to be able to continue on." And it raises a really interesting ethical question, because if you default to saying, "Well, fine, I'm cutting it off because this group said we should cut it off," aren't you also disservicing the second group because they actively want you to promote these things? Yeah. So I don't think this is not a question that has an easy answer. But I would say, at least in terms of Panlex, and for the record, we actually haven't encountered this yet that I'm aware of. Now, that could be partially because, getting back to his question, we may need to promote more. But in general, as far as I know, we have not had this come up. But our game plan for this is, if a community says they don't want their data in our database, then we remove it.
Okay, because we have come up with it in Wikidata and Wikipedia, for instance.
You have?
And Commons.
No, really?
It's been a problem.
Yeah, I can imagine, so. Especially in Commons for photos of certain things.
Correct. Yeah.
Hi. I had a question about the crowdsourcing aspect of this.
Mm-hmm.
As far as going in and asking a community to annotate or add data for a data set, one of the things that's a little intimidating is, like, as a editor, I can only see what things are missing.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm going to spend time on things, having an idea of there's a list of high priority items.
Mm-hmm.
That's very motivating in this aspect. And I was curious if you had a system which is essentially like, we know the gaps in our own data. We have linguistic evidence to know that these are the ones that if we had annotated, these would be the high impact drivers. Like, I can imagine having the lexeme for house, very impactful, maybe not a lexeme for Dadaism or the like. But I was curious if you had that data and if it was something that, like, that could be used to drive these community efforts.
Great question. One thing that Wikidata has a whole lot of, Panlex has a whole lot of, are Swadesh lists. We have apparently the largest collection of Swadesh lists in the world, which is interesting. If you don't know what a Swadesh list is, it's essentially a regularized list of lexical items that can be used for analysis of languages. They contain a really basic set. So there's a couple of different kinds of Swadesh lists, but it's either 100 or 213 items, and they might contain words like house and eye and skin and basically general words that you should be able to find in any language. So that's like a really good starting point for having that kind of data available. And it's but otherwise we don't necessarily now. As I mentioned before, we crowdsourcing is something that we don't do yet, and we're actually really excited to be able to do. And that's one of the things I'm really excited to talk to people at this conference about is how crowdsourcing can be used and the logistics behind it. And these are the kind of questions that can come up. So I guess the answer I can say to you is that we do have a priority list. Actually, one thing I can say is we definitely do have a priority list when it comes to which languages we are seeking out. So the way we do this is that we look for languages that are not currently served by technological solutions, which are oftentimes minority languages, or usually minority languages, and then prioritize those. So, in terms of individual lexical items, being that the general way we get new data is essentially by ingesting an entire dictionary's worth, we are relying on the dictionary's choice of lexical items, rather than necessarily saying we're really looking for the word for house in every language. But when it comes to crowdsourcing, we will need something like that. So this is a opportunity for research and growth.
Hi, I'm Victor, and this is awesome. Can you talk about as you have slides here? Can you talk a little bit about the technical status that currently you have data or information flow between, like from and to Wikidata and Panflex? Oh. Is that currently implemented already? And how do you deal with like back and forth or even feedback loop information mm-hmm. between Panflex and Wikidata?
So we actually don't have any formal connections to Wikidata at this point. And this is something that I'm really excited to talk to people in this conference about. We've had some interaction with Wiktionary, but Wikidata is actually a better fit, honestly, for what we're looking for. Having directly lexical stuff means that we have to do a lot less data analysis and extraction. So the answer is we don't yet, but we want to.
And if not, what are the obstacles? And as we can see, Wikidata already supports several languages, but when I look up translate.panflex.org, mm-hmm. you apparently support many, many variants, mm-hmm. Much more than Wikidata. How do you see there's a gap between like translation or lexical translation first application mm-hmm. versus an effort as trying to map the knowledge to a knowledge structure?
Mapping knowledge will actually be very interesting. We've had some very interesting discussions about the way that Wikidata organizes their lexical data, your lexical data, and how we organize our lexical data. And there's subtle differences that would require a mapping strategy. Some of which will not necessarily be automatic, but we might be able to develop techniques to be able to do this. You gave the example of language variants. We tend to be very splittery when it comes to language variants. In other words, if we get a source that says that this is the dialect spoken on the left side of the river in Papua New Guinea for this language, and we get another source that says this is the dialect spoken on the right side of the river, then we consider them essentially separate languages. And so we do this in order to basically preserve the most data that we can. Being able to map that to how Wikidata does it, actually what I would love is to have conversations about how languages are designated on Wikidata. We go with a strategy of very much a splittery strategy. We broadly rely on ISO 6393 codes, which is provided by the ethnologue, and then each individual code, we then allow multiple variants within it, either for script variants or regional dialects or sociolects, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, again, opportunity for discussion and work.
Hi, I would like to know if you have a OCR pipeline, and especially because we've been trying to do OCR on Maya, Mm-hmm. And it's just, we don't get any results, you know, it's just, it doesn't understand anything. And so if your pipelines are available, and the other one is just on the overlap of ISO codes, like sometimes they say, oh, this is a language and this is another language, but there are sources that say other stuff, as you were mentioning, and but they tend to overlap. So how do you go on, you know,
Yeah, no, that's absolutely amazing question. I really, really, really like it. So we don't have a formalized OCR pipeline per se. We do it on a sort of source by source basis. One of the reasons why is because we oftentimes have sources that don't necessarily need to be OCR'd that are available for some of these languages, and we concentrate on those because they require the least amount of work. But obviously, if we really want to dive deep into some of our sources that are in our backlog, we're going to need to essentially develop strong OCR pipelines. But there's another aspect too, which is that, as you mentioned, like the people who design OCR engines, I think are not realizing how much you can stress test them. Like, you know what's fun? Trying to OCR a Russian Tibetan dictionary. It's really hard. It turns out that we gave up and we hired someone to just type it up. Which was totally doable. And actually, turns out that this amazing Russian woman learned to read Tibetan so she could type this up, which was super cool. So, I mean, like, this, oftentimes when you get to, I mean, I think that if you're dealing with stuff in the Latin script, then I think that OCR solutions can be developed that are more robust, that deal with multilingual sources like this, and expect that you're going to get a random four in there if you're dealing with some, like, 16th century Mayan sources, you know, like the digit four. There are some sources that OCR is probably just never really going to catch up to or require such an immense amount of work actually we put a little bit of this to use right now. We have another project we're running in Panlex to transcribe all of the traditional literature of Bali. And we found that in handwritten Balinese manuscripts, there's just no chance of OCR. So we got a bunch of Balinese people to type them up. And it's become a really cool cultural project within Bali, and it's become, like, you know, news and stuff like that. So I would say that you don't necessarily need to rely on OCR, but there's a lot out there. So, like, having good OCR solutions would be good. So also, if anyone out here is, like, into, like, super multilingual OCR, please come talk to me.
Thank you for your presentation. I have a question. You talked about the integration between Panlex and Wikidata, but you haven't gone to the specifics. So I was checking your license, data license, and it is under CC0.
Yes.
That's really great. Mm-hmm. So there are two possible ways that either we can import the data, or we can continue something similar to the Freebase way, where we had the complete database from the Freebase, and we imported them, and we made a link external identifier to the Freebase database. So if you have something in mind, are you thinking similar, or you just want to make a independent entity or independent database which can be linked to the Wikidata?
Yeah, so this is a great question, and actually I feel like it's about one step ahead of some of the stuff that I've already been thinking about, partially because like I said, getting the two databases to work together is a step in and of itself. I think, like, the first step that we can take is literally just pooling our skills together. We have a lot of experience dealing with stuff like classifications and properties of individual lexemes that, you know, I would love to share. But being able to link the databases themselves would be wonderful. I'm 100% for that. It would be a little bit easier on the Wikidata towards Panlex way, but maybe I'm just biased because I can see how that could work. Essentially, as long as Wikidata is comfortable with all the licensing stuff like that, then or we work something out, then I think that would be a great idea. We just have to figure out ways of linking the data itself. One thing I can imagine is essentially that I would love for edits to Wikidata to immediately become populated to the Panlex database, without having to essentially just re-ingest it every X. So essentially making Wikidata a crowdsourceable interface to Panlex would be really, really awesome. And then being able to use Panlex intermediate translations to be able to do translations across Wikidata lexical items, that would be glorious. So.
This is like the origin promise of the semantic web to close holes by inference. What's if we think this further, this kind of translation, how do you deal with semantic mismatch and grammatical mismatch? For instance, if you try to translate something in German, you can simply put several words together and reach something that's sensible. And on the other hand, I think I read sometimes that not every language has the same granular system for colors, for instance. So
it's, you said every language has a different system for colors or the same?
I remember maybe it's just about evolution of language that they start out with black and white and then,
yeah,
then
it gets the color hierarchy. Yeah. Yep. Actually, the color hierarchy is a great way to illustrate how this works, right? So essentially, when you have a single pivot language, like it's really interesting when you read papers on machine translations, because oftentimes they'll talk about some hypothetical pivot language that they say, oh yeah, there is a pivot language, and then you look read in the paper and it's like, it's English. And what this form of lexical translation does, by passing it through many, many, many different intermediate languages, it has the effect of being able to deal with a lot of semantic ambiguity. Because as long as you're passing it through languages that contain the same, like reasonably similar semantic boundaries to a word, then you can avoid the problem of essentially introducing semantic ambiguity through the pivot language. So using the color hierarchy thing as an example, if you take a language that has a single color word for green and blue, and it translates it into blue, right, which in your single pivot language, and then into another language that has different ambiguities on these things, then you end up introducing semantic ambiguity. But if you pass it through a bunch of other languages that also contain a single lexical item for green and blue, then essentially that semantic specificity, it gets passed along to the resultant language. As far as the grammatical feature aspect, Panlex has been primarily in its history collecting essentially lexemes, like essentially lexical forms. And by that, I mean essentially whatever you get is a headword for a dictionary. So we don't necessarily concentrate at this time on collecting grammatical variant forms, like things like nominative and dative, et cetera, or past tense, present tense. But it's something that we're looking into. One thing it's always important to remember is that because our focus is on underserved, endangered, and minority languages, we want to make sure that something is available before we make it perfect. So it's about a phrase I absolutely love is, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, and that's what we attempt to do. But we are super interested in the idea of being able to handle grammatical forms and be able to translate across grammatical forms, and it's some stuff we've done some research on, but we haven't fully implemented yet. Mm-hmm.
So of the 7,500 or so languages, I assume you're relying on dictionaries which are written forms, but do all those languages have standard written forms, and how do you deal with...
That's a great question, and essentially, yes, a lot of these languages, as everyone's aware, are unwritten. However, any language for which a dictionary has been produced has some kind of orthography, and we rely on the orthography produced for the dictionary. We occasionally do some slight massaging of orthography if we can guarantee to be lossless, basically. But we tend to avoid it as much as possible. So essentially, we don't get into the business of developing orthographies for languages because oftentimes they have been developed even if they're not really widely published. So for example, for a lot of languages that are spoken in New Guinea, there may not be a commonly used orthographic form, but some linguists come up with something, and that's a good first step. So we also collect phonetic forms when they're available in dictionaries, and so that's another way in, essentially an IPA representation of the word, if that's available. So that can also be used as well, but we don't use that. We don't typically use that as a pivot because it introduces certain ambiguities.
Thank you.
This might be a super silly question, but are those only the intermediate languages you work with?
Is there Oh no.
Oh yes. Thank you.
I'm glad you answered the question. So this is actually a screenshot snapped from translate.panlex.org. If you do a translation and then you'll get a list of translations on the right side, and you click a little dot 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 button, you'll get a graph like this. And what this shows is the intermediate languages, the top 20 by score. I could go into the details of how we do the score, but it's not super important now. By score. That are being used. But to make the translation, we're actually using way more than 20. The reason I cap it at 20 is because if you have more than 20, like this is actually kind of a physics simulation, you can move the things around and they squiggle. If you have more than 20, your computer gets really mad. So it's more of a demonstration, yeah.
Well.
Leila from Wikimedia Foundation. One note on, you mentioned Wikimedia Foundation a couple of times in your presentation. Mm-hmm. I wanted to say if you want to do any kind of data ingestion or collaboration with Wikidata, perhaps Wikimedia Deutschland would be a better place to have these conversations with because Wikidata lives within Wikimedia Deutschland and the team is there. And also the community of volunteers around Wikidata would be the perfect place to talk about any kind of ingestions or working with kind of bringing Panlex closer to Wikidata.
Great, thank you very much, because honestly, I'm not exactly super familiar with all of the intricacies of the architecture of how all the projects relate to each other. I'm guessing by the laughs that it's complicated. But yeah, so basically we would want to talk with whoever is responsible for Wikidata. So you just do a little sub replace thing, just, you know, whoever is responsible for Wikidata. That's who we're interested in talking to, which is all of you, volunteers. So, any further questions? Okay, well, if anyone does end up having any further questions beyond this or wants to talk about like details and specifics about these things, please come and talk to me. I'm super interested, and especially if you're dealing with anything involving lexical stuff, anything involving endangered and minority languages and underserved languages, and also Unicode, which is something I do as well. So, but yeah. So thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me to come speak. I'm hoping that you enjoyed all this.